This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, we might be confined to the noose that is the Beltway, but today we talk to a guy who lives in a real live swing state, folks. Paul Blessed, a journalist based in Raleigh, North Carolina, will join us to talk politics in toss-up Tar Heel State.
Poor Paul, living in North Carolina. We'll hear all about his troubles there. Also, Trump has raged on and on and on about China quite a bit this election.
China!
Well, now the East Asian power had a few choice words back for Trump over the GOP nominee's commitment to killing a climate treaty. We'll recap the dust up in our sludge report.
Finally, the last thing Hillary Clinton needed this week was a reminder that voters don't exactly trust her. So good for her then that the White House's chief trade negotiator was talking up chances of the TPP passing. We'll be bringing you that story in a People's Bulletin.
Yes. What does the White House know that we don't know and that nobody in Congress knows when they're so confident that the TPP is going to pass in a lame duck session?
I think they're just talking it up. I think they got nothing, and I don't know. But anyway,
yeah,
we'll get there.
We'll get there. But first, man, I've been exhausted the last few days fighting the good fights on Twitter and social media. I know, like, the world isn't what Twitter is.
You
know?
Yes, this is true.
That, like, my timeline doesn't reflect the views of the world.
Yeah.
But increasingly, it's difficult to accept that notion. Anyway, on that subject here, I don't even know how to get into the stuff we need to talk about here in Block A, but let's just start by talking about Tony Schwartz. He's a guy, he knows Trump well. He's an author. He was the ghostwriter for Trump's book, The Art of the Deal. And he hates Trump. You know, he knows Trump well, worked with Trump closely, and he hates Trump. Schwartz thinks that Trump would be a grave threat to the nation if elected. In Schwartz, this week sent out a reminder to people on Twitter about Trump. And he said, quote, "Never forget, Trump will ban all Muslims, believes Mexicans are rapists, pays no taxes, feels free to assault women, and lies compulsively."
Those are some pretty important things to remember.
All traits you look for in a United States president. Anyways, Schwartz, just put that out there. Never forget. Remember, this is the GOP nominee. Someone who has demonized an entire race of people, an entire religion, who brags about sexually abusing women, who lies about everything. Unfortunately, though, people are forgetting about this. They are forgetting about the true Trump that has come to be revealed over the last year during this campaign. Because with less than a week to go until voters hit the polls, not that anybody's counting over here, but with less than a week to go, the Clinton campaign is not on the trail stumping about Trump's Muslim ban, his deportation posse, or his sexual harassment. Instead, they're talking about Russia. Instead, they're talking about the FBI and attacking James Comey. Clinton camp this week, several times, not once, not twice, not three, several times, tweeted out links to a Franklin Foer article on Slate that has since been completely debunked, but that alleged that there was a secret internet link between the Trump campaign and a major Russian bank, Alpha Bank. Now, Foer had tried to pitch this story to multiple outlets. All of them rejected it. Slate finally accepted the pitch.
Oh, gosh. Slate? Slate?
A Slate pitch.
Slate.com?
Yes. They published the extremely flimsy report yesterday, which was then promoted several times by the Clinton campaign. The New York Times has stepped forward, countering the story, with a report noting that the FBI sees no clear link to Russia while investigating Donald Trump. The Times piece specifically mentions the Foer allegation about the secret link to a Russian bank, noting, quote, "FBI officials spent weeks examining computer data showing an odd stream of activity to a Trump organization server and Alpha Bank. Computer logs obtained by the New York Times show that two servers at Alpha Bank sent more than 2,700 lookup messages, a first step for one system's computer to talk to another, to a Trump-connected server beginning in the spring. But the FBI ultimately concluded that there could be an innocuous explanation like a marketing email or spam for the computer contacts.
Oh, gosh, what a surprise that a bank would be trying to desperately hit up Donald Trump.
Yes, and sure enough that these innocuous explanations were indeed what was happening. The Washington Post piled on, attacking the Fuller report, saying, quote, for all of Fuller's exegesis of the situation, culminating, he admits, with a lack of certainty about what it all means, it seems likely that the simplest answer isn't that someone affiliated with Trump or his campaign set up a back-channel method for contacting someone at Alpha Bank in Russia. It seems more likely that the human tendency for pattern-seeking is extracting a conspiracy theory from the automated clunkiness of the way the internet works. The Intercept also has a pretty thorough takedown of the Fuller piece published on Tuesday. So too do a number of computer researchers, including people who were cited in the Fuller piece, coming out saying that the Fuller piece is garbage.
I've got to say, I read his book. It came out like over a decade ago. It's called Globalization, How Soccer Explains the World.
Yeah.
It sucked. I mean, it was okay. I don't want to bash it too much. Maybe he didn't choose the title.
Yeah.
I know that sometimes publishers will be like, you got to go with this title or we're not doing it. You know, the same way that editors sometimes pick headlines, except never for us because we're a two-man guy. So yeah. It's either you or me.
We play each other in ping pong to determine who...
We do
it's
it.
The
we
headline
it.
When there's a disagreement.
But we will play 3-day-long Civilization 6 games.
Yes.
To settle editorial disagreements.
In fact, we have like 8 stories backlogged, ready to be published on the website, but aren't because we have to determine who wins our current Civ 6 match on what the headlines
That's
will be
right.
for all the articles.
We can actually bring down every major political figure in Washington.
We're
sitting on these stories, but... We're arguing about the exact wording of the headline, and we're currently in about, what is it, year 1392 in this Civ game?
Yeah, things are getting pretty heated.
So I think once someone discovers gunpowder, we will sort that out.
Things will move really quick.
Anyway, Franklin Foyer, his book, just wasn't that good. It didn't explain the world, but it kind of, you got snapshots of different parts of the world, I guess. But it was still kind of this very liberal, like, oh, globalization is good because look at soccer kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's also not so good, but...
Globalization is good. Look at soccer and my taxi cab driver told me so.
Yeah, yeah.
So ultimately, no story here. Despite Franklin Foer's best efforts here, there's nothing. So why does the Clinton campaign feel the need to obsessively promote debunked articles days out from an election? I mean, if this was the only dirt that they had on Trump, if this was the only bad stuff that existed on Trump, then maybe I could see you might be desperate and try and throw anything at the wall. Maybe Franklin Fuller will pick it up and maybe it'll have legs. But folks, there hasn't been a dirtier candidate to run for office probably ever.
Yeah.
You can pick and choose what you want to attack Trump on. It's not hard. You're not grasping at straws here. So why choose the garbage that's been reported and all the misinformation that's coming out? Why is the Clinton campaign so obsessed with Russia when their opponent is objectively bad for endless number of reasons that have nothing to do with Russia? And besides, I remember there was polling on this recently about what comments from Trump you found most offensive, and like people polled overwhelmingly said that Trump mocking the reporter with the disability was the most offensive thing. The least offensive thing to them was Trump's praise of Vladimir Putin. Point is, American people don't really care about this stuff.
Yeah, there is.
You're not going to get any voters after a year of campaigning of people who are, I'm okay with Trump abusing women. I'm okay with the Muslim ban. I'm okay with all this stuff. But hey. He might have a secret link to a Russian bank in his campaign. That's too much for me. It's too much for me. Let me add also here something about FBI Director Comey. Clearly, he's stepped in it. I don't think he's broken the law, but he's definitely stepped in it. I will say this, though, and I hate defending FBI directors. I almost never do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I am going to flirt with it a little bit right here. Comey's stated reason for why he informed Congress last week of the new developments in the Clinton email investigation was that, one, he feared that the details would leak anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he would be accused then of a cover-up if he didn't get in front of it.
Yep.
I've watched Comey over the last few months spend hours and hours and hours testifying in front of Congress, being accused of everything you can think of by Republican lawmakers. I have seen endless leaks come from the government and the FBI. I find Comey's explanation here completely plausible. I genuinely believe he was afraid of a leak, at which point the GOP would have gone nuts, accused the FBI of not being transparent or of lying, misleading them when they said that the Clinton investigation was over. In that scenario, this alternate scenario in which the information was leaked and not, you know, volunteered by Comey, would have played out much worse in this week leading up to the election than this has currently played out.
I've got to say, having watched James Comey operate, whatever, testify before Congress, generally exist as a public official, I don't think this is high on his list of things he wants to do.
What, like tip the election?
Or just have to weigh in on this at all. He seems much more interested in trying to undermine personal privacy on your iPhone. He seems more interested in, you know, peddling bogus theories about the Ferguson effect and, you know, unconditional defense of cops, which I think, by the way, is why some people suspect he might be trying to tip it toward Trump.
Oh, so that they don't have to enact reforms related to police violence?
Just because a lot of cop unions are pretty pro-Trump.
Yeah.
Trump is pretty pro-cop, so that makes sense. But yeah, it's at the end of the day, you know, this doesn't really seem like much of an October surprise. We've known for months, actually over a year and a half, that Clinton had these email problems. I'm not exactly sure this qualifies. And it just seems like they're just getting so mad. It's like the textbook example of a person getting mad online at someone else for their own actions, right? I mean, like, this was Hillary Clinton's fault, this email business.
Yeah.
And
if Comey really wanted to tip the election, he could have done it a few months ago. He could have recommended charges.
Yeah.
A 2-paragraph letter to Congress last week ain't going to do it.
And there's also more stuff about the Clinton Foundation probably that he could dredge up. But I mean, it does seem very plausible that this is just totally innocuous and part of the Anthony Weiner investigation. And
yes,
quite honestly, it seems like there's regret that Weiner was ever a part of that circle. You know, when he's Huma Abedin's estranged husband.
Yes.
They've since separated. Since some of his
and there's
scandals.
Reports that these emails might have been a backup from her phone that ended up on the phones. Either way, I don't doubt that this is innocuous, most likely.
Yeah.
The Clinton campaign is making this much worse and making this a bigger issue by accusing the FBI director of breaking the law.
And by the way,
of meddling in the election, and even people like Howard Dean going as far to connect Comey to Putin.
One more thing, though, is, you know, assume that their theories and Democrats' reaction to this is, you know, proper in some, you know, in some capacity. If you're the Clinton campaign, why don't you just sit there and let Harry Reid do your dirty work for you?
Yeah.
By, for example, the letter he sent Comey accusing him of violating the Hatch Act, accusing him of sitting on information about the investigation into Trump and Russia.
Yeah.
Why not just, I mean, that was a big enough bombshell. That was, it was dominating the news on Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And not to mention Comey's little bit of news, his disclosure, it's resulted in quite a windfall for the Clinton campaign, actually. Campaign announced that it raised more than $11 million in just 3 days after the FBI director's announcement. The Hill reported that record-breaking figure is the most Clinton has raised over a 72-hour period since she became the nominee at the Democratic convention in July. So that worked out pretty well. All right, enough on all of that. People just seem to be losing their minds here in the last week until the election. Like, I was you know, on the computer the other night.
Yeah.
Doing my thing. And there's serious journalists posting things, speculating that Putin personally has a Trump sex tape and that Trump is being blackmailed by the Kremlin. That's the explanation behind all of this. Like, serious journalists positing that information on Twitter, that is what's going on here, is that Trump was lured into an orgy when he was visiting Moscow. He was videotaped, and that's the dirt that the Russians have on him to get him to bend to their will. Serious people saying this stuff. Although, if a sex tape was released of Donald Trump, he would probably just brag about it.
You know, I thought about that theory, and people were floating that theory. There are two counter arguments to that. One,
yep.
He's bad at sex. Two, he has a small dick. And actually, he made a claim in the, what was it, one of the Republican debates.
He said, there's no problem down there.
There's no problem down there. He said his wiener is huge.
Which is exactly what someone with a tiny wiener would say.
Exactly. And if it comes out that his wiener is, in fact, not huge, that's an issue for his credibility. I'm not trying to, like, you know, make him conform to this masculine ideal. He made the claims that he's got a huge dong. So whip it out.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out how much of what we just said is allowable on the air, if we can say wiener or not.
I think wiener's okay.
Maybe not dick, but we'll find out. Sorry, we keep saying it. You're going to have to have a lot of work to do, our editors here. Just to close things out, Paul Ryan, he voted early.
Yeah.
He voted for Donald Trump.
Hey.
Said, I stand where I've stood all fall and all summer, voting for Trump. John Kasich also voted early. He voted for John McCain.
Nice.
Both candidates are bad. Both candidates are bad. More dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you. From Washington, D.C.
So less than a week now, folks. Just less than a week till the election.
Yes, six days.
Just 6 days. Who could believe this day would come where it would be 6 days? Only 6 days away. I feel like a kid 6 days away from Christmas. In one state, the entire country, not just me, will be watching with great anticipation on Tuesday. A place where seemingly all the marbles are up for grabs is the Tar Heel State, the great state of North Carolina. A solidly Republican red state until recently, Hillary Clinton has been slightly ahead of Donald Trump, according to a spate of recent polls. But honestly, who knows at this point? Mitt Romney won it for the GOP in 2012. President Obama took the state for Dems in 2008. It's safe to say that the state is anything but safe for either candidate on Tuesday. The Senate race, too, in North Carolina is hotly contested. Republican Richard Burr is defending his seat from Democratic challenger Deborah Ross. The current Senate Intelligence Committee chair is up by less than 2 points, according to a Huffington Post running analysis of the polls, and the result could impact the balance of the power on Capitol Hill when the 115th Congress convenes in January. And not to be forgotten, embattled North Carolina Republican Governor Pat McCrory is fighting for his political life. In the spotlight nationally in recent weeks, months, because of his state's anti-transgender bathroom bill and its voting restrictions, some of which were shot down by federal appellate judges, McCrory is down 51-45, according to a recent Wall Street Journal Marist poll. So the parties have everything to fight over in North Carolina next Tuesday, and therefore we have brought on a local to talk more about state politics. And while there might be disputes over whether he is the best, there can be no dispute that he is the blessed. Joining us now to talk more about this situation in the Tar Heel State, returning to Unanimous Dissent for his second appearance, is journalist Paul Blessed. See, now you get my joke. Paul is a staff writer at Indy Week, which is a progressive news publication, and it's based in the Raleigh, North Carolina area. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Paul.
Thanks for coming. So right off the bat, Paul, we recorded this interview right after oral arguments in a case that your publication has brought against the McCrory administration. So you told me earlier today. What's this all about, and how is litigation proceeding thus far?
Basically, well before I came on at Indy Week, we and a coalition of five other media groups and two nonprofits filed a lawsuit against the McCrory administration because they don't answer public records requests whatsoever.
Yeah.
They just ignore them. I mean, I send emails all the time that just kind of get thrown away. So the oral arguments were heard today at the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and the defendants, basically their argument is that they have sovereign immunity, that the governor has sovereign immunity, and he just doesn't have to answer public records requests because the court can't offer any injunctory relief to any of these media groups. So their argument is that the governor doesn't have to follow the public records law.
Does that apply to all requests or just the ones he deems are privileged?
So in my experience, since I came on in March, I've sent 8 public records requests to the communications director, Josh Ellis, and I've only had one answered. The only one that was answered was basically just like, no, we didn't spend any money on that. And the other 7 were, you know, for various things like, you know, how much did you spend here? Did you, you know, make any, or like, can I have the communications between you and the staffer, between McCrory and this other staffer? And they just don't answer them. So we're actually filing another 2nd lawsuit, and some of the other publications, the Charlotte Observer just filed a 2nd lawsuit on their end because they sent emails asking for, you know, McCrory emails regarding HB2 when HB2 passed, and it was just ignored. And when they filed the 2nd lawsuit, they finally got the emails. So it's basically just us hounding them in the courts in order, you know, to get them to comply with their obligations.
And for our listeners who don't know, HB2, of course, is the anti-transgender legislation that I referenced before in the intro.
Yeah.
It seems like the governor is undermining his own argument if he responded to one of your requests to say, no, we didn't spend that money on, but can't respond to the others.
Yeah, that's kind of the weird thing about it. I mean, they just don't really want to, you know, comply with it. And, you know, we've sent these kind of requests to other members of the executive branch. So the lieutenant governor is even crazier than McCrory, Dan Forrest. His campaign posters say, run, Forrest, run. Not joking. They actually answered our request. You know, we made the exact same request asking them, you know, about their emails surrounding HB2. And, you know, it took them a month, but they got them to us. And McCrory still hasn't done that.
Well, I don't know much about how public records laws work in North Carolina. It definitely sounds like something sketchy is going on. But I want to talk more about McCrory and the election more generally. As I noted, most people out of state seem to know your governor for his support of HB2 or his support for legislation restricting voting rights. How are most North Carolinians sizing him up? What is really on their minds when they're considering who to vote for on Tuesday?
So HB2, I think, is a big thing, but not for the reasons that, you know, most of us would like. It's really driven business out of the state. You know, this is a state where Amendment 1, which is the last constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage before Obergefell, this is the last state where something like that passed, and that passed in 2012 when McCrory won his first election. So, you know, this isn't the most progressive state on civil rights, but, you know, it's kind of generally been known historically as a moderate pro-business state, and a lot of business has been lost because of that. I mean, Charlotte lost the All-Star game, of course. The NCAA and the ACC have pulled out of North Carolina.
The All-Star game, you're talking about the NBA All-Star game, right?
Yeah, the NBA All-Star game, which was supposed to be here next year, and they moved it to New Orleans. So a lot of people, you know, basketball is huge here. People hate that. You know, PayPal, even though PayPal donates to the Republican Governors Association, they pulled out jobs from this planned expansion that they had in Charlotte. So it's really hit the state hard economically. There's a couple other things, you know, there was a coal ash spill a couple of years ago, and the McCrory administration has really just bungled that completely. There was, without getting into too much detail, he used to work for Duke Energy, and Duke Energy was the ones that manned the coal ashes or the coal ash ponds. And after there was a spill there in 2014, and they haven't really put any sort of pressure on Duke Energy to clean it up the right way. The fines that they've made have just been, you know, not really anything to write home about. And, you know, there's been, you know, concerns that it leaked into the drinking water of people that live in that area. And, you know, we've had a state epidemiologist resign over this. The chief of staff for the governor called a late night press conference saying that the person that was the scientist who was making these claims, Ken Rudo, he was lying in his sworn testimony. And then, you know, a couple weeks ago, it came out that the chief of staff hadn't even read the testimony when he accused him of lying. So there's a lot of, this is a state where Roy Cooper, who is the challenger to McCrory, could win and Trump could win. It's kind of hard to imagine, you know, what a Roy Cooper, Donald Trump voter looks like, but McCrory is more unpopular than Donald Trump in this state.
Data on North Carolinians that have already cast their votes show that the share of early voters who are Black is down. Any indication this is the result of Republicans' restrictions on voting? I know that there were some restrictions that were thrown out by the Fourth Circuit. The court said that the laws surgically targeted African Americans. How about some of the laws that weren't stricken down? Are they having an effect?
So early voting was one of the things that were restricted under the voter ID law, and that was also struck down. A lot of people think that so there's two things at play here. So early voting was decreased from 17 days to 10 days in the voter ID law. When the ruling came down, they expanded it back to 17 days. The problem is that the State Board of Elections and the County Board of Elections across 100 counties are all run by Republicans because in the County Board of Elections, it's three people. Two are Republicans because the Republican or the governor is Republican. So the counties themselves were able to draw up these, new early voting plans for the extra 7 days now that it was, mandated by the courts that they needed to do that. So in some counties, like Wake County, the early voting plans weren't that bad. And Wake County's early voting is up, I think 7% this year as compared to 2012. But in Guilford County, which is where Greensboro is, and Greensboro is, I think, a majority African-American city, and the third largest city in the state, 250,000 people, there's only one early voting site for the first 7 days. Mm. So turnout in Greensboro was down 85% from 2012 to 2016 in the first 7 days. Wow. Now, they expanded the sites to 25 in Greensboro and Guilford County. Now that we're in the last 10 days of early voting. But yeah, I think that's definitely had a huge impact on African-American turnout. And there's also been voter purges. The North Carolina NAACP just filed a lawsuit against three counties, including Cumberland, which is where Fayetteville is, alleging that there has been, voter purges.
Through the cross-check program, is it?
Yeah, it was mail. So one guy in particular, they sent mail to his house about the election. It came back undeliverable. And it turns out this guy still lived in the same county, but he had moved into a nursing home. So, it's
caging.
Just like these, And it's just repeated attempts to, disenfranchise Black voters. And they've given the reasons. There was a big Washington Post story about this in August, I think, where, one of the Republican strategists basically said, we're disenfranchising them, but it's because they're Democrats, not because they're Black. So it's like, it's pretty to be totally honest.
Clinton had a lead of like 6 points in North Carolina a few weeks ago. The latest polling has that lead down to 1 point. There could be a number of reasons for it. I'm going to posit a reason that a bunch of Democrats and liberals gave a bunch of money to the North Carolina Republican Party. North Carolina politics received national attention recently. A building owned by the Republican Party was firebombed, and immediately, Silicon Valley liberals reacted by raising over $10,000 for the North Carolina Republican Party without waiting for the investigation or bothering to check about the party's insurance policies, and without realizing that the Republican Party is connected to tons of rich guys who seem very eager to support the kind of bigoted garbage that North Carolina conservatives pump out on a regular basis. So I guess the question is a two-parter. One, what's the status of the investigation into that firebombing, first and foremost? And two, as a lefty yourself who lives in North Carolina, what were your thoughts on that whole crowdfunding program?
So the investigation is still ongoing. Apparently the same day there was graffiti somewhere at the Hillsborough County Democratic Party.
Did Republicans raise a bunch of money to clean it off?
No, they didn't. Republicans didn't raise any money for Democrats to clean it off. And I don't know if you saw this, but in Ohio, somebody dumped a bunch of manure in front of a county Democratic Party the other day.
I saw that.
And I still haven't seen a Kickstarter for that. So, yeah. And second, so it's total bullshit. I don't know if you guys know Cato of Utica. He wrote a really good blog post about this.
Yeah. At Cato of Utica on Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. He's a great guy. And I think that, so if there's anything that liberals love more than winning the right way, I don't know what it is. It's just, I mean, this is a state that's just been destroyed by Republican policies over the past 6 years. I mean, we had a Racial Justice Act that was just gutted. And now, you know, you have all these people sitting on death row for no reason. And the Racial Justice Act, sorry, was an act that basically allowed people who were sentenced to death to bring a claim to court saying, you know, this is in violation of my civil rights because the death penalty is used disproportionately towards African Americans. I mean, abortion restrictions, unemployment insurance has been gutted. Just the whole nine yards, HB 2, Amendment 1, it's they just don't, I don't think that people who live in California and New York really get that this state is in such disrepair in terms of public services and civil rights and all that stuff. And it's mind blowing to me that they started a GoFundMe to raise money for these people. I mean, you can condemn the firebombing, but you know, Trump said, you know, as soon as this happened that it was Hillary Clinton's people. I mean, this is who you're donating money to. If you're so scared of Donald Trump, if you're so frightened of Pat McCrory and you know, this constant attack on LGBTQ rights, why would you give money to these people? It's mind blowing to me. And the other thing is that Orange County is one of the most liberal counties in the state. I mean, it's where Chapel Hill is, and the other big town is Carrboro, which is, you know, basically like, you know, little Portland. So, I mean, these are like very liberal. This is a very liberal county. It was pretty obviously, you know, either anarchists or just, you know, somebody who had a bone to pick with both parties. But, you know, the fact that they, you know, immediately, you know, banded together to help the scrappy Republicans is just absolute bullshit to me.
At least they can pat each other on the back online. Paul, we have 1 minute left about, and I just wanted to get your take really quick. Do you think Senator Burr is going to lose?
I think it's a tight race right now. I keep kind of waffling back and forth on this, but I think that it really depends on the top of the ticket. If Trump is able to eke out a win, I think Burr stays. I think that Clinton needs to win by like 4 or 5 here in order to give Deborah Ross a solid chance. I don't know if you saw, but yesterday, Richard Burr got in trouble for making comments about, you know, basically the same exact thing as the Second Amendment people comments that Trump made back in August. And he said he was proud to have blocked a judicial appointment on Obama's behalf to the district court. So I think that that's, you know, it'll take a couple days for that to sit in. And I'm not sure if that's going to affect the vote too much, but I think if it does, then Ross has a solid chance of winning.
That would be definitely a surprise pickup for Democrats in North Carolina. Journalist Paul Blest, staff writer at IndyWeek, progressive news publication in Raleigh, North Carolina. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Paul.
Thanks for having me, guys.
More dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. And in fact, we're going to get to some of those reports right here on this radio show in the coming minutes. But first, time for some economic news for the 99%.
Well, I don't like to normally wade into the winning the week discourse, but Hillary Clinton has unquestionably had a bad few days. Wah, wah. The last thing she needs after the revisiting of the email issue by the FBI are more questions about her untrustworthiness. That matter came up in the subtext of headlines Tuesday about President Obama's most cherished trade initiative, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In an interview with CNBC, U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman said he is hopeful the TPP will be okayed by the House and Senate between next week's election and this sitting of the next Congress, the so-called lame duck session. If they bring it forward, I think we can get the votes there, Obama's top trade negotiator said. The trade agreement eliminates 18,000 taxes on our exports, Froman also claimed, and members of Congress are starting to see that. The TPP, of course, is opposed by both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And while there is considerable doubt generally about what Trump's true stance on most issues is, considering how often he changes his mind and tends to spout his mind off the cuff, Trump's opposition to the TPP has been more consistent than that of Hillary Clinton's, who only came out against the deal in October 2015, right before a primary battle with longtime trade critic Bernie Sanders.
What up, Bernie?
What up, Bern? Clinton announced her opposition just after the deal was finalized. Her campaign has noted in defense of her position, but even the wisdom of that timing can now be scrutinized thanks to WikiLeaks' publication of John Podesta's emails. Sorry, John.
We got to do it, though, John.
Now, this requires a little bit of background. As Congress was considering trade promotion authority, a legislative vehicle required for large multilateral trade agreements, it managed to insert a provision that barred the U.S. from negotiating an agreement with any country named to the lowest ranking, Tier 3, of the State Department's annual Trafficking in Persons report. The amendment was aimed at holding the Obama administration to account. It had claimed TPP was the most progressive trade deal ever, with new labor protections. And it was also aimed squarely at Malaysia, a party to the TPP, and a routine Tier 3 country that, observers said, did not merit a Tier 2 ranking improvement in 2015. But when the Trafficking in Persons report came out a few weeks later, lo and behold, Malaysia was declared a Tier 2 country.
How did that happen?
So Clinton's labor outreach director, Nikki Budzinski, flagged this matter in an email sent on July 9th to Podesta and other members of the Clinton communications team. Hi, I wanted to provide a heads up on the next issue likely coming our way on TPP. Obama just readjusted Malaysia's tier on the human rights list in order to move TPP through with Malaysia attached. She goes on, Trumka will likely be putting out a statement today blasting this. She continued referencing AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. I have heard that we will soon be asked to weigh in given the secretary's role at state and as a presidential candidate, but Zins concluded, wanted to provide this heads up. Let me know if I can help or you have questions. 8 days later, she sent out another email to the same cast of characters, again asking for opinions in a brief on labor issues ahead of an AFL-CIO Executive Council meeting. The new twist on TPP with the White House State Department adjusting Malaysia's human trafficking standard to clear a path for conclusion of Malaysia in TPP will most definitely come up, Budzinski wrote. From a political perspective, is this an opportunity for HRC to provide a specific example of something that would be a no-go for her with trade, she asked. And again, Budzinski reiterated, quote, there will be significant pressure for the secretary to state a position on this given her experience at the State Department. 2 weeks later, on August 3rd, Reuters reported, quote, the government office set up to independently grade global efforts to fight human trafficking was repeatedly overruled by senior American diplomats and pressured into inflating assessments of 14 strategically important countries in this year's Trafficking in Persons report. In all, analysts disagreed with U.S. diplomatic bureaus on ratings for 17 countries, Reuters reported, the worst ratio in the 15 history of the State Department's human trafficking unit, known in insider parlance as JTIP. And you better believe Malaysia, of course, was one of the countries whose rankings were doctored. But still, the Clinton campaign stayed silent on the issue. Now, they came out against the TPP after it was finalized 2 months later after that August Reuters report. But again, to borrow from the question asked by Nikki Budzinski, from a political perspective, this was an opportunity for HRC to provide a specific example of something that would be a no-go for her with trade, and she did not do that. Maybe she didn't want to embarrass President Obama. Maybe Clinton wanted to wait until the full text of the agreement was released. Your campaign has said that was the case. But when she did come out against it, the former Secretary of State made no mention of Malaysia or labor specifically. I'm worried about currency manipulation not being part of the agreement. Clinton also said she was worried about the provisions on pharmaceutical companies would have given fewer benefits to patients and consumers. According to the Podesta emails, by the way, one powerful person was extremely concerned about the Malaysia issue. Prepare the drudge siren.
That was a weird siren.
Thank you.
But I picture that the drudge siren would be weird.
That was good. Anyway, this powerful person was liberal billionaire financier George Soros. Soros spokesperson Michael Vachon noted in a March 2016 email to Podesta, "I have attached a memo on TPP in Malaysia, and it may come up when you see George and Michael," Soros' son. The memo, prepared by Open Society Foundation board member John Pang, was extremely critical of the Obama administration's policy toward the Malaysian government. Reading now from the paper, "The Obama administration has set back the fight against human trafficking by compromising the credibility of its own chief instrument in that struggle, JTIP. Also, quote, there have been strong general objections to the content of the TPP and its opaque, big business-driven negotiation process." You've lost George Soros. I don't know. Now, anyway, moving on to our environmental news segment. It's the latest edition of the Sludge Report.
Oil spill stretching for miles.
A torrent of methane gas is spewing into the air.
The Sludge Report.
So, as we all know, Trump loves talking about China, or as he calls it, China.
China.
We know his whole spiel by now, his campaign stump speech, China's taking our jobs, China's taking our wealth, all of that. We hear it on a pretty much a daily basis from the Trump campaign. Well, on Tuesday, China fired back a little bit. It took the country took the Donald to task for pledging to rip the Paris Climate Agreement up. That agreement was approved by more than 190 nations last year in an effort to reduce rising global temperatures. According to Reuters, China's top climate change negotiator, a guy named Xi Zhenhua, told reporters, quote, "I believe a wise political leader should take policy stances that conform with global trends." He was being asked about how China might negotiate with a future Trump administration on climate change issues. Zhenhua added, quote, "If they resist this trend, I don't think they'll win the support of their people, and their country's economic and social progress will also be affected." By the way, Trump has previously alleged that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese government. So I doubt he's going to be the best guy to be leading negotiations if he was elected with the Chinese government on climate change issues. Anyways, regardless of what Trump believes, the rest of the world believes the planet is indeed getting hotter and something needs to be done about it. In September, both the U.S. and China ratified the Paris Agreement. And to fulfill its obligations to reduce global warming, Beijing is preparing to launch a carbon trading system next year. President Obama, meanwhile, has proposed the Clean Power Plan. It's an initiative we've talked about on this show before that would slash carbon outputs by nearly one-third in this country by 2030 through emission caps on new energy plants. During a speech in September, Trump falsely claimed that the Clean Power Plan would, quote, shut down most, if not all, coal power electricity plants. And that is a claim that you can file next to his other claim about China creating global warming as a hoax. But Republican lawmakers, you know, the responsible people in the Republican Party, they too have worked tirelessly to kill the Clean Power Plan. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called on states earlier this year to ignore the pending regulations. Also, 24 Republican states, led by their secretaries of state, or attorneys general probably, led by their attorneys general, they've filed suit along with industry groups to block implementation of the Clean Power Plan, claiming it violated the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. The legal action prompted the Supreme Court in February to halt enactment of the proposal until the suit has been resolved in the lower courts. That process began in late September when the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in the case against the Clean Power Plan. Ahead of those proceedings, an industry group known as the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity peppered the D.C. area with ads calling for a judgment against the Clean Power Plan. Just gives you a taste of how much the industry wants to kill this initiative. They ran a citywide ad blitz that was targeted not at, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who live in D.C. and voters and members of Congress, but instead at just 10 judges who sit on the D.C. appellate court.
Sticking with matters that impact the dirty energy industry, General Electric and oil logistics company Baker Hughes reached a deal over plans to merge. Under the scheme, GE would spin off its oil and gas assets and $7.4 billion in cash to a company that would be 62.5% owned by the giant multinational. Baker Hughes would own the remaining 37.5%. The Wall Street Journal noted that the new company would have $32 billion in revenue, and it could, quote, cut costs to better compete with rivals such as Schlumberger Limited to provide equipment and services to oil rigs and wells.
Schlumberger.
Yeah, I have never heard the name Schlumberger Limited before, but it is now my new favorite corporation, Schlumberger. I got that Schlumberger spirit. I don't know.
Yes, yes. Some go home, make some Schlumbergs later.
Yeah, yeah. I remember in Office Space, the boss, Bill Schlumberg.
All right, go on.
Enough of that. GE said the deal should see earnings per share increase by 4 cents in 2018 and by 8 cents in 2020. And investors seem to generally agree, with shares in the company increasing by 1.1% on Monday morning. Shares in Baker Hughes were up 0.2% around the same time. The proposed merger has occurred amid the backdrop of sliding oil prices, although they're kind of on the way up, still low in recent history. It went from $100 per barrel in 2014. They're around $50 currently after hitting less than $30 per barrel earlier this year. Additionally, the deal might not be legal. Baker Hughes had entered into a $35 billion deal to merge with Halliburton, Dick Cheney's beautiful son.
Love that boy.
But it was rejected earlier this year by the Obama administration. The proposed merger, Attorney General Loretta Lynch said, would substantially reduce competition into 23 separate markets for oil field products and services, and it would turn many of those markets into non-competitive duopolies.
Interesting. Let's see if they hold the same logic when it comes to the AT&T Time Warner merger.
Which is?
Pending.
Yeah, true. Finally, a quick update about the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. Amnesty International sent human rights observers late last week to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota, the epicenter of demonstrations and resistance to the pipeline. The move came the day after cops arrested over 140 people and used pepper spray, tasers, sound cannons, rubber bullets, and beanbag rounds against protesters.
Known as less lethal measures.
Less lethal, yeah, exactly. Democracy Now! Noted that those arrested claim to have been put in dog kennels by cops who also allegedly wrote numbers on the detainees' arms.
Hmm.
Yeah. Amy Goodman, the renowned co-host of the program, herself was arrested in September while covering a crackdown on protesters, one that included the sicking of attack dogs on demonstrators. Goodman was later charged by state prosecutors with attempting to incite a riot. That indictment was tossed out in October by a state judge.
Or else there likely would have been an actual riot there if that was allowed to stand, for sure.
Separately, last week, officials from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation called on the Justice Department to investigate civil rights violations that occurred during the protest. I say allegedly here to cover my legal bases. A lot of us have seen the images from the protests, and well, to me, they look like civil rights violations.
Yes.
Sicking attack dogs on protesters, less lethal weapons, using my air quotes here.
People just exercising their First Amendment rights of protest, being arrested. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In a letter to Loretta Lynch sent early last week, Standing Rock Sioux Chair Dave Archambault said that, quote, peaceful protests are being met with military vehicles and heavily armored law enforcement personnel in riot gear. Rather than seeking to keep the peace, Archambault said, law enforcement personnel are clearly working in tandem with private security of Dakota Access. According to the Huffington Post, DOJ wouldn't directly reply to the charges, but said, quote, the Justice Department is taking this situation in North Dakota seriously. Of course, the Standing Rock Sioux is alleging that the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline will contaminate waters close to their reservation, sacred waters, important lands, et cetera.
And this is an issue that a few politicians have jumped front and center on. I know Bernie Sanders did a tweet storm this week about all the reasons why people should be opposed to Dakota Access Pipeline. Elizabeth Warren has come out, said things about Dakota Access Pipeline. We know that Hillary Clinton hasn't been willing to go as far. She released that statement this week, a very kind of generic milquetoast. Both sides need to come together and work out a solution. You know, Clinton is those type of is from that type of politician that waits for the parade, waits for the movement to join together, and then wants to get in front with the flag and say, "Oh, I've been here all along."
Yeah,
we know she hasn't been there all along, but one way, I guess, to get her there is to keep pressuring her, keep up the protests, keep up the agitation. I know everybody on Facebook is pinpointing their location to the site of these protests.
Yeah, they're just checking in on Facebook.
And to screw with cops who are probably checking social media to see who's going to be there and everything.
Yeah, I don't know how well that's working, but I think that's fodder for another show.
Yes. Pay attention to the story. It's one of the most important things happening now. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio, and stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in DC so you don't have to be.